Chapter 2. A Dream Come True. 10 months had now passed since Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, commander of the Japanese Combined Fleet, remarked almost casually to Rear Admiral Takajiro Onishi, Chief of Staff of the 11th Air Fleet, "If we are to have war with America, we will have no hope of winning unless the U.S. fleet in Hawaiian waters can be destroyed." Then he ordered Admiral Onishi to start studying the possibility of launching a surprise attack on Pearl Harbor. Onishi called in Commander Minoru Genda, a crack young airman, and 10 days later Genda came up with his appraisal. Risky, but not impossible. Yamamoto needed no further encouragement. A few trusted subordinates went quietly to work, and by May, Rear Admiral Shigeru Fukudome of the Naval General Staff was able to toss a fat notebook at Rear Admiral Ryunosuke Kusaka. "Go ahead, read it," invited Fukudome. Kusaka plunged into a mass of statistics on Pearl Harbor, but missed any operational plans. "That," said Fukudome, "is what I want you to do." The job seemed overwhelming. The U.S. strength looked enormous. Hawaii was thousands of miles from Japan. There were airfields scattered all around Oahu: Hickam, Wheeler, Ava, Kaneohe, probably others. Pearl Harbor itself was narrow and shallow, making it extremely difficult to get at the ships. On top of everything else, Vice Admiral Nagumo, commander of the 1st Air Fleet and slated to lead any attack, was dragging his feet. As Chief of Staff, no wonder Kusaka was discouraged. "Don't keep saying it's too much of a gamble just because I happen to be fond of playing bridge and shogi," Admiral Yamamoto cheerfully admonished. "Mr. Kusaka, I am fully aware of your arguments, but Pearl Harbor is my idea and I need your support." He added that it would certainly help if Kusaka could win over Admiral Nagumo. Kusaka worked on, and somehow the move began to make sense. Commander Genda did wonders with the torpedo problem. All summer he experimented on the inland sea, setting up short, shallow torpedo runs. By August, he was trying out shallow-draft torpedoes at Saiki. As for the short length of run, well, there was Southeast Lock, a narrow arm of water that led like a bowling alley straight to the battleship moorings in the center of Pearl Harbor. Everything was done in the darkest secrecy. One afternoon, late in August, Lieutenant J.G. Toshio Hashimoto, a young naval pilot, took some papers to his wing commander's office and found a group of high-ranking officers poring over charts and maps of Pearl Harbor. They were stamped top secret, and Lieutenant Hashimoto was appalled at his intrusion. Nobody rebuked him, but he went away petrified by the mere knowledge of such an enormous secret. By the end of August, Admiral Yamamoto was ready to unveil the scheme to a select few. Admiral Osami Nagano, Chief of the Naval General Staff, and 13 other key officers were called to Tokyo and given the word. Then, from September 2nd to 13th, they all tested the idea on the game board at the Naval War College. The attacking team lost 2 carriers. Admiral Nagano began complaining that December was too stormy. Admiral Nagumo, commander of the all-important 1st Air Fleet, still had cold feet. Other officers argued that Japan could take Southeast Asia without U.S. interference, that if America came in, the place to catch the fleet was nearer Japanese waters. But Yamamoto stuck to his guns. If war came, America was bound to be in it. Her fleet was Japan's biggest obstacle. The best time to crush it was right away. By the time it recovered, Japan would have everything she needed and could sit back and hold out forever. This logic won the day out for, and on September 13th, the Naval Command issued the rough draft of a plan that combined Pearl Harbor, Malaya, the Philippines, and the Dutch East Indies in one huge assault. Next, the training stage. One by one, men were tapped for the key jobs. Brilliant young Commander Mitsuo Fuchida was mildly surprised to be transferred suddenly to the carrier Akagi, having just left her the year before. He was far more amazed to be named commander of all air groups of the 1st Air Fleet. Commander Genda sidled up with the explanation, "Now don't be alarmed, Fuchida, but we want you to lead our air force in the event that we attack Pearl Harbor." Lieutenant Yoshioshiga and about 100 other pilots got the word on October 5th from Admiral Yamamoto himself. Knox swore them to secrecy, told them the plan, urged them to their greatest effort. The men practiced harder than ever, mostly the low, short torpedo runs that had to be mastered. The torpedoes themselves continued to misbehave in shallow water, diving to the bottom and sticking in the mud. Commander Fuchida wondered whether they would ever work. But Genda only grew more excited. Once perfected, they would be the supreme weapon. And by early November, he had succeeded. Simple wooden stabilizers were fitted on the fins, which would keep the torpedoes from hitting even the shallow 45-foot bottom of Pearl Harbor. Meanwhile, other pilots practiced bombing techniques, for nobody except Genda was completely sold on torpedoes. Besides, the meticulous intelligence now pouring in from Consul General Nagao Kita in Honolulu showed that the battleships were often moored in pairs. Torpedoes couldn't possibly reach the inboard ship. To penetrate tough armor-plated decks, ordnance men fitted fins on 15-inch and 16-inch armor-piercing shells. These converted missiles would go through anything. While the pilots practiced and the inventors worked their miracles, Admiral Kusaka battled the red tape that snarls anybody's navy. Sometime during October, he flew to Tokyo to argue headquarters into giving him 8 tankers for the task force that was now taking shape. It meant the difference between using 4 or 6 carriers, and at a time like this it seemed incredible that there should be any question about it. But headquarters hemmed and hawed, and it took several weeks to wangle the extra ships. 33-year-old Suguru Suzuki, youngest lieutenant commander in the service, had a more stimulating job. Around the end of October, he boarded the Japanese liner Taiyo Maru for an interesting journey to Honolulu. Instead of following her usual course, the ship sailed far to the north, crossed over between Midway and the Aleutians, and then cut south to Hawaii, exactly the course the task force planned to follow to avoid detection. Lieutenant Commander Suzuki whiled away the trip taking reams of notes. He checked the winds, the atmospheric pressure, the roll of the vessel. Could a scouting seaplane be launched in these seas? It could. Would any special refueling problems arise? They would. He observed that during the entire voyage, the Taiyo Maru didn't sight a single ship. In Honolulu, Lieutenant Commander Suzuki spent a busy week. From occasional visitors to his ship, he learned that the fleet wasn't now assembling at Lahaina Anchorage as it used to. He confirmed that the weekend was a universally observed American institution. He picked up some choice tidbits, structural data on the Hickam Field hangars, interesting aerial shots of Pearl Harbor taken October 21st. These were made from a private plane that took up sightseers at nearby John Rogers Airport. Anybody could do it. Then back to Tokyo again, guardedly comparing notes with Lieutenant Commander Kiyoshihide Maijima, who was also on board. Commander Maijima seems to have had much the same interests, but directed rather more toward submarines. By now, things were moving fast in Tokyo. November 3rd, Admiral Nagano's final blessing. November 5th, Combined Fleet Top Secret Order No. 1, spelling out the plan. November 7th, Admiral Nagumo officially named commander of the Pearl Harbor Striking Force. The same day, Yamamoto tentatively set the date, December 8th, or Sunday, December 7th, Hawaii time. Good for a number of reasons. Favorable moonlight, perfect coordination with the melee strike, the best chance to catch the ships in port and the men off duty. A few more people were let in on the secret. Admiral Kusaka confided in Commander Shinichi Shimizu, a middle-aged supply officer. The problem, how to draw winter gear without attracting attention when everybody else was getting ready for the tropics. Commander Shimizu's solution? Requisition both summer and winter gear. He glibly told the startled depot that if war came, you never knew where you might go. Then he piled everything on the freighter Hokomaru and chugged off to sea about November 15th. Once out of sight, he swung north and made for Tangute Bay in the bleak, cold Cure Isles, the secret rendezvous point for the Pearl Harbor Striking Force. Admiral Nagumo himself was not far behind. His flagship, the carrier Akagi, left Saiki in the late evening of the 17th. His chief of staff, Admiral Kusaka, tingled with optimism. Only the day before, he had received a letter from his old housekeeper telling of a pleasant dream. The Japanese submarine fleet had achieved a splendid surprise victory at Pearl Harbor. A strange dream for a housekeeper, but Admiral Kusaka thought it was a good omen. On November 19th, Lieutenant Commander Suzuki arrived back from his junket to Honolulu and took a fast launch to the battleship Hiei, anchored off Yokohama. Suzuki climbed aboard with his bulging briefcase, and the Hiei, too, steamed off for Tankan. One by one they slipped away, always separately, never any apparent connection. Once out of sight, the sea simply swallowed them up. At the great Kure Naval Base, A while ago, the radio traffic crackled from the rest of the ships, designed to give the impression that the fleet was still at home. The regular carrier operators stayed behind to give these signals their usual swing. A wireless operator's touch is as distinctive as his handwriting. The camouflage was so good it even fooled Admiral Kusaka, who bawled out his communications man for breaking radio silence, only to find the message was a fake, concocted back home. One by one they glided into Tankan Bay, the lumbering carriers Akagi and Kaga, the huge new flat top, Zuikaku, the light carriers Hiryu and Soryu, the old battleships Hiei and Kirishima, the new crack cruisers Tone and Chikuma, 9 destroyers led by the light cruiser Abukuma, 3 leading submarines, the 8 tankers finally wangled from headquarters. Last to arrive in the twilight of November 21st was the great carrier Shokaku, which put on such an effective masquerade of turbine trouble that she was almost late.